This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm David Wilk, your host. Today, we're doing a recording by an author as part of a series that I've started called Authors' Voices. And that is, today's reader is Gail Brandeis, the author of Delta Girls. Delta Girls is a novel that's set in, or it's written in two different voices. Two different characters run throughout the book. And but the book is really set primarily in the Delta of California, the Sacramento River Delta. And Gail is with us today, and she's going to read from the beginning of the book, from each of the two separate beginnings, the one about the character Izzy and the other one about the character Karen. So, Gail, thanks for doing this with us today, and welcome to the show.
Thanks so much, David. It's really a treat to be here. And I'm going to start by reading a section from Izzy's voice. Pears ripen best off the tree. When I picked beefsteak tomatoes in Illinois, the farm stand owners wanted fat, red fruit. In the Arkansas field, it was easy enough to pop a strawberry into my mouth, my daughter's mouth, when the foreman wasn't watching. But pears you have to pick when they're green and hard, when they're not ready to yield to a thumb, a tongue. They may drive you wild with their scent, but they'll resist your teeth, make your lips and gums burn. Pears derailed us on our way to a blueberry farm in Washington, a family-run place that supposedly welcomed children and paid a decent wage. I had just left my job as a watermelon cutter in Niland, California, near the Mexican border. My task was to slice fruit from its vine and hand it to the pitching crew that followed me around the dusty field. They hefted the melon from one man to the next, bucket brigade style, until it reached the pickup truck where it was stacked like wobbly cordwood. My daughter Quinn, meanwhile, sat under a nearby tarp with her third-grade math sheets, face flushed, water bottles surrounding her like a packaged moat. We left before harvesting was finished. I didn't have a contract like the rest of the crew, whose broker sent them from farm to farm. As a free agent, it was easy for me to take off, find another job. Most small farmers were willing to pay a woman under the table. I only had a problem if they expected something under the table in return, or if they wouldn't let my 9-year-old homeschooled daughter out on the field with me. I always hoped my dark hair, my skin tan from so much time outside, would help me fit in with each new set of fellow workers, but they inevitably pegged me for a gringo right from the start. Quinn's pale blue eyes probably contributed to this. The fact that I barely understood Spanish after all my time on the circuit didn't help either. I hadn't minded the melon picking. I felt kind of like a midwife as I eased the ripe fruit through the thatch of wood wool that protected it from sunburn, as I cut the stubborn umbilical cord, handed the bulky baby over to its line of waiting fathers. But the heat was another issue. A fellow cutter, a pregnant 19-year-old, had fallen ill from sunstroke, and I didn't want to risk that with Quinn. Plus, the pitching crew made me nervous. I didn't like the way the first guy in line would hover over me as I knelt by the fruit so his crotch would be right in my face when I turned around. Didn't like the way the group joked about me in Spanish. I would have felt even more vulnerable if it hadn't been for the knife in my hand. It was good to be on the open road again, zipping up the belly of California. A car can get claustrophobic when you're parked for the night, when you're trying to sleep with the seat reclined as far as it can go, your whole body aching, your clothes sour, your daughter squirming in the back seat behind you, the air like an oven even with the windows open. But when you're driving and she's sitting beside you and the scenery is changing from desert to mountain to farmland, a mint-green 20-year-old Mercury Zephyr is a fine place to be. Quinn put her grimy flip-flops up on the dashboard. How much longer, Ema? She asked, turning the vents to blow more air on the backs of her knees. Her faded turquoise shorts rippled and snapped around her legs like sails. I'd never told Quinn that Ema was Hebrew for mother. I'd never told her to call me that, but she'd been doing it since she was a baby. She never said Mama, just Ema. If we drive straight through 24 hours... She made a noncommittal sound and then went back to her book and her bag of Funyuns. Quinn and I had fallen into the habit of eating convenience store food on the road, negligibly healthy things we could get for cheap, squishy bread with peanut butter, string cheese, granola bars, jerky, the occasional rubbery hard-boiled egg, tomato juice in lieu of fresh vegetables, plus a rotating string of treats. The Funyuns filled the car with their bullion cube tang, and I couldn't help but reach into the bag and crunch a few myself. I had a weakness for junk food and didn't mind the extra bit of heft it gave my belly, my thighs. My body was strong, if achy, from all the farm work. My body was there for me. It did what I needed it to do. Might as well reward it with some salt and grease. We entered a stretch of I-5 with orchards on both sides of the road. The fruit on the trees was too small to identify as we barreled past at 80 miles per hour, sun flashing between the neatly planted trees like a strobe light. Pistachio, I found out when we stopped at a gas station. A small produce stand in the lot was selling bags of the pale green nuts, along with peaches and corn and wedges of watermelon and tubs of ice. Need any pickers? I asked the woman running the stand, her white hair buffeted by the hot wind. My mouth was dry from the chips, my skin and eyes dry from the summer air. I was tempted to buy some watermelon, even though Quinn and I had glutted ourselves on it for days. We would hijack melons that had busted open in a fall or developed sugar crack on the vine. Back at our campsite after work, we'd plunge our hands straight into the sweet, mealy innards. We must have looked like lions feasting on gazelle, pink pulp hanging off our faces, juice pouring down our arms. "Nah," said the woman. "We use machines. Shake the nuts right off the tree." I gulped another bottle of water as we continued up the I-5. My whole body felt parched. I found myself wishing we had taken the longer route up the coast just so we could see the ocean shimmering beside us. When we crossed what looked like a river in Stockton, I was ready to rip off my clothes and dive in. Instead, I pulled over to check the air in my tires. "Is this the Sacramento River?" I asked a guy who was refilling his wiper fluid. "It's the Deepwater Ship Channel," he said, green liquid glugging sweet through his funnel. "You want to see the river? Go to the Delta." He handed me a laminated map, one made for boaters. As soon as I saw the spiderweb of waterways, I knew I had to check it out. Over 1,000 miles of water twisted through the Sacramento River Delta, the river routed by levees and dikes, creating wetlands and estuaries and little islands that didn't look like islands, a few palm trees parked amongst the willow and oak to remind you you were still in California. The rich peat soil farmland was so dense with minerals it was known to combust. Pears grown in the Delta made up more than half the state's crop. Delta water made up more than 2/3 of California's drinking supply. I didn't recognize the pear trees at first. Highway 160 was a tall, levee road. It looked down at the Sacramento River on one side, vast orchards on the other. At first, I thought the farms were level with the asphalt, the treetops shrubs. They looked like giant tortoises hulked on the ground. I had a sudden image of Quinn getting out of the car and leaping from shell to leafy shell as if they were stepping stones. I couldn't figure out what sort of fruit grew on such strange, stubby plants. Then I turned a bend and could see the length of their trunks, all the empty space between them. I felt a little dizzy, thinking of how far Quinn could have fallen. And I'm going to jump ahead now to Karen's section. This is Karen. Lifts were her favorite. To the average viewer watching pears in an ice arena or on TV, it looked as if the guy was doing all the work, as if all the girl had to do was look pretty and let her partner bear her up to heaven. But a partner couldn't lift a girl who wasn't lifting herself, too. When she was over her partner's head, his hand pressed into her ribs or stomach or the side of her thigh, she had to harden herself against his palm, his thumb, lift herself away from it. Otherwise, she would end up with a hand-shaped bruise on her skin, maybe a cracked rib, and that's if she didn't fall. Karen liked lifts because everything looked smaller, more manageable from the air. The judges with their score sheets, the television people with their cameras, her mother in fur boots leaning against the boards. For those few seconds of height, none of them mattered. They were earthbound, finite. She was soaring. She was towering. She was sweetly, briefly above it all, the closest she could get to escape. Nathan Main was different from Karen's skating partner of 5 years, Brian. Nathan didn't treat her like a princess or a butterfly. He didn't apologize for shoving his hand between her legs during a lift or catching a couple of strands of hair under his blade during a death spiral. "You can take it," he said, and she realized that she could. Nathan treated her like a woman, a body, strong and capable, worthy of desire. Her mom, Dina, treated her like a body, too, but a body that needed to be changed, perfected, a body that was never quite right. Platinum diet since 11, nose job at 13, a countless string of diets. With Nathan, it was, "Here we are in our skins. What are we going to do about it?" Karen was nervous when her mom first suggested pairing with him. His latest partner, Tabitha, was recovering from a concussion and a fractured vertebra. Karen's partner, Brian, had gone off to Harvard to study French literature and be surrounded by smart boys. Regionals were only 2 months away. Part of Karen hoped her mom wouldn't sign to her new partner. Part of her hoped she could sit this competition cycle out, stay away from the ice long enough to want to get back on. But she knew her mom would never let that happen, especially not with the Olympics coming up in a little over a year. "He has the best triple axel of any pair skater out there," Dina said. "Just think of it. With your jumps, you'd be brilliant together." Dina had groomed her daughter to be a singles champion, but when Karen was 12 and placed sixth at junior and sectionals, Dina told her she didn't have the chops to go it alone. "You have the jumps, sweetheart," she said, her voice matter-of-fact, her eyes calm, but not the pizzazz. Brian had stellar technicality enough to get them on the podium of most regional competitions and close to placing at nationals, but Nathan had pizzazz. Groupies followed him from town to town, most holding signs like, "Marry me, Nathan, and watch out, Tabitha, Nathan's mine." He and Tabitha had placed third at nationals the previous year and had done respectably at Worlds. They were considered America's next great hope until he dropped her in the middle of a Detroiter, a lift band from competition during a summer tour. Karen was 17, Nathan 22, when Dina arranged a private early morning tryout session, the sun just starting to send a hint of itself into the sky. Nathan showed up at the rink in Connecticut on a pale green Vespa and jeans and a tight yellow t-shirt, his skates in a black leather backpack, just as Karen and her mom pulled up in their BMW. He wore a multicolored knit beanie instead of a helmet, his dark shaggy hair swooping out in tufts. Karen tried not to look at the nipples poking under his shirt. He hadn't shaved in a couple of days. His blue eyes were bloodshot when he took off his sunglasses. "Not used to getting up so early," he said as he shook Dina's hand. She gave a coquettish shrug that made Karen wince. "But you're worth it, sweetheart." He turned to Karen, looking her up and down. "You're worth every second of missed sleep." Nathan stepped onto the ice before Karen, which startled her. Brian had always given her the courtesy of entering the rig first. Nathan's hair was a bit flat on top after taking off his beanie, but it streamed up like flames as soon as he started to stroke quickly around the rink. Karen took more leisurely strokes, waiting for him to catch up with her rather than racing to catch up with him. He held out his hand as he drew near. She grabbed it, and he surged ahead, practically ripping her shoulder out of its socket. "Find your rhythm," Dina yelled from the penalty box, looking giddy and nervous. Karen sped up and Nathan slowed down, and soon they were stroking side by side, doing crossovers at the end of the rink, their legs moving in perfect tandem, his left arm behind her back, her right across to his front as they held hands. Nathan was taller than her other partners, older. She could feel the difference in the way he held her hand, in the smell of sweat and cigarettes and some sweet musky scent Karen couldn't name, in his physical presence beside her. Nathan was solidly in the world, every muscle. She felt her own muscle fiber pack into something more dense, grounded as they skated together. She felt a current of power run through them, a bright circuit through their arms and chest. Maybe this could work after all. "Show me what you got," shouted Dina. Karen looked at Nathan with her eyebrows raised. He winked and said, "Let's blow her little mind." They tried a few twist lifts, armpit holds, waist holds, hand-to-hip lifts, lasso lifts, press lifts, side-by-side camels, then flying camels. Side-by-side jumps, then throws, first doubles, then triples. She loved the air he gave her when he threw her into a triple loop, loved how he held her lower back when they did a pair of sit spins, how her leg pressed against his when they tried a spiral sequence. "This is how it's supposed to feel," she thought with wonder as she leaned back into his chest during a spread eagle. With Brian, she always felt as if she was skating with herself, as if she were holding her old hand, comfortable, familiar. Nathan was another creature, maybe even another species. The contrast was invigorating. "One more lift," her mother called from the penalty box, "and let's call it a day." This time, Nathan did something with his thumb when she was over his head. A little wiggle between her legs. It caused a zing to go through her body all the way to the top of her skull. A sudden flood she hoped wouldn't drip down his arm. She almost tumbled off his palm, but somehow stayed upright, her one hand clutching his wrist so hard it left marks. "What was that?" she asked, still catching her breath. She could barely look at him as they slipped on their skate guards and stepped off the ice. "I don't know what you're talking about." He shook his wrist. She couldn't tell if he was smiling or smirking. "Don't do it again," she said as firmly as she could. He held her gaze until she flushed and looked away. She could hear him chuckle under his breath as he walked toward the lobby. That was brilliant. Her mom strode up to her. Somehow, even in her puffy down jacket, she looked sleeker than Karen could ever hope to be. Utterly brilliant. I don't want to skate with him. Karen unzipped her sweater. Sweat ran down her sides and cheeks. Nathan brought something out in you, Karen, she said. I've never seen you skate like that before. Karen brushed past her and ran to the bathroom, her skate guards clapping against her blades. She peeled her skating dress and tights down her body and sat in the stall, head in her hands. The cool air felt wonderful against her flushed skin. She wished she had worn underwear so she'd have something to throw away. She dabbed at the damp crotch of her tights with toilet paper before she pulled everything back up, the fabric cold and clammy between her legs. Nathan and her mother were sitting with cups of coffee by the snack bar. The morning figure skating session was about to begin. The lobby was now filled with sleepy-eyed skaters, the diehards who were already skating both before school and after. Some of their mothers kneeled before them, tightening their laces. Others stood behind them, tightening their buns. Karen forced herself to smile at the girls, who waved excitedly in her direction. She wondered if any of them missed the days when skating was just for fun, when it wasn't about competition, the endless, impossible quest for perfection. Before she started on the competitive track, rising up the rungs of the United States Figure Skating Association testing system, Karen took classes at a rink that followed the more recreational Ice Skating Institute program. She started at the most basic alpha level, then moved on to beta, then gamma. She loved learning how to fall, how to swizzle, how to glide on one foot, wiggle backwards. Just being on the ice filled her with joy. But then she couldn't pass her delta test. She could do the three turns, the outside edges, and the bunny hop just fine, but she couldn't seem to get the hang of the shoot the duck. Every time she crouched down and tried to lift one leg in front of her like a rifle, she toppled onto her bottom. Her mother got more and more exasperated, especially after Karen failed the test the second time. What is wrong with you? Dina had demanded, her face more fierce than Karen had ever seen it. If you can't pass this test, you can't move up to freestyle. Do you want to be stuck doing bunny hops the rest of your life? Do you want to be a Delta girl forever? At the time, Dina made this sound like a fate worse than death, but looking back, it didn't seem so bad to Karen. What would life be like if she had stayed a Delta girl forever? Someone just starting to learn, just moving for the pure joy of it? Someone who skated only for herself, who didn't have to worry about other people's judgment, other people's hands? She slipped onto a green fiberglass bench next to her mother. So, Dina said, not looking up from her clipboard, we can rent the rink early on Mondays and Tuesdays. Other days you'll have to skate during club time, 3 hours a day minimum, even more at the beginning, and we'll have to figure out the dance and Pilates sessions. I look forward to it. Nathan smiled at Karen, and the anger inside her chest unknotted and dissolved. A sudden weakness filled her limbs. And, as if she had never said or felt anything to the contrary, she took a deep breath and said, me too.
Yeah, that was great.
Thank you,
Gail. That was Gail Brandeis reading from her novel, Delta Girls. And this has been Author's Voices for Writer's Cast. Thanks so much.